note
on the thing. So
we usually just do like a, we kind of format it more like a book, I guess, on film. Like we kind of do like a subject with a title, and then we'll kind of cover that and edit everything together.
Okay.
Without asking, there's usually not a person asking questions. It's more like a, I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I know that. All right, so there might, the question might actually appear on the screen.
It would probably just fall under, we'd probably edit whatever you're talking about into, I guess, the subject that we're talking about.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Well,
probably doesn't matter.
Yeah, you got visual things going on with your hands
right
there.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, it'll probably just be edited in to what you're talking about. Because I'm guessing he has some other people in this, I think.
Oh, I imagine, yeah. Long document. You want to get different voices from different perspectives, especially if he's going to be, you know, connecting in with postmodern Christian theology, then he'll probably talk with some people who are into that stuff, too.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. All right, well, why don't we... where's my makeup artist? Hey, you know more about makeup than I do.
The
Hey, do I look beautiful?
No.
Oh. Hmm. Yes, they do. That's right.
Okay. All right. Well, if you just want to try to look at me and not the camera and...
Oh, fair enough. Okay, I'll do that.
Hairbrush.
All right, we're going to start now.
I'll go get my hairbrush for you.
Oh, hairbrush.
Oh.
I thought you were saying airbrushing.
Yeah, airbrush.
That's
airbrushing.
It, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right.
All right.
All right, so we're going to start with the... key themes of the Enlightenment and why they're modern. Enlightenment is usually considered the long 18th century, anywhere from late 1600s on through early 1800s, sometimes ended by the Napoleonic Wars ending around 1815, sometimes going back to the 1688 when there's a change in England and parliamentary system becomes dominant then. But the key themes of Enlightenment thinkers are they see themselves as getting past centuries and perhaps even millennia, right, of superstition and dogmatism that has really kept human beings in both ignorance, poverty, and subjugation. So their movement is self-consciously revolutionary in an intellectual self. They see themselves as finally figuring out philosophically and to some extent religiously and politically and economically what we need to do to lift human beings right out of ignorance, poverty, and submission. So the core themes are and what makes them modern, right, is a break with then what we now call kind of a pre-modern world. And again, that label, historians will debate exactly when modernity, right, begins, but we can pick something like the 1400s or the 1500s, right? So certainly in terms of exploration, right, everything leading up to Columbus, right, in 1492 is significant, so 1500, right, is pretty close. Right, religiously, right, we can talk about the Martin Luther and the Reformation, so the 15 teens, right, is significant there. We have, right, by this time, the foundations of the modern sciences, astronomy, physics, and so on, being put in place. So Copernicus in the 1540s is going to be, right, significant, and so on. So what we then have is one of the main themes is that the moderns are much more naturalistic, right, in their thinking, that we are interested in the natural world and understanding it, right, in its own terms. We're going to explore it as explorers, but also as scientific, right, explorers, and we're going to come to see how it works. And the contrast there is then to pre-modernism, if you think of, say, the era from 500 to 1500, where it's much more religious philosophy that is dominant, right, and so our focus is on the supernatural dimension, understanding God, and theology, right, is the queen of everything, and we understand the world as primarily illustrating or embodying God's plan, right, for humans and the destiny of the world. We see things in terms of omens and signs of what God's purposes are. What starts to happen then in the early modern world is to bracket a lot of the religious focus. People are still essentially religious, but we're studying the natural world right in its own terms. Another emphasis here is more in terms of cognition and what in philosophy we call epistemology. What counts as real knowledge? Now, the pre-modern answers, right, are to emphasize, of course, scripture or the authoritative interpretation, right, of scripture that is, say, captured in the church, right? So in the Western European tradition, you either base things in scripture or you base things in the institutionalized authoritative interpretation, right, of scripture. But the authority of scripture then, of course, goes back to the various prophecies or revelations that are seen as being visited directly from God to prophets, or in some sense a mystical experience that are inspired, right, by God and so forth. And if you're not one of the people who is chosen by God to be a prophet, you're to have faith, right, in the prophets, right, or you're to have faith in the interpretation of scripture as it comes down through the authorized institutions. So what we then have at the core then of pre-modern, right, epistemology or pre-modern cognition is an emphasis on concepts of revelation, mystical insight, faith, and the authority of institutions and tradition. What happens in the early modern world is that all of that is challenged, right, and it's replaced by an epistemology that emphasizes each individual's own experience, right? So each person has the capacity for looking at the world, interacting with the world, and forming judgments based on their own experience. Or in the case of scripture, and this is partly what feeds into the Protestant Reformation, each individual has the capacity to read scripture for himself or herself and form his or her own judgment, right, about what scripture means, and therefore form a direct relationship with God. Or as scientists do, we can study the world and then start to develop scientific method and various sophisticated tools, mathematics and experiments and so on, to interpret nature, right, as it really is. And anybody, right, in principle, with good education, can become a scientist. So what we then have is a prioritization of experience, right, and reasoning, right, and these are seen as pretty widely spread, right, among the population with appropriate education, and all of those men then mean a challenge to just taking on faith, right, somebody else's report of a mystical revelation, right, or taking on faith someone's report of something that ended up being put into a scripture, right, 1,000 years ago. And interpreted by, right, other people and so forth. So we're more naturalistic, we're more experience and reason based by the time we get into the modern world. I would say another element is an increasing individualism, right? Obviously in feudal times, feudalism and tribalism are the dominant modes of social organization in the pre-modern world, but you see yourself first and foremost as a member of a tribe. And you're born into a tribe, and what your function in the tribe is by and large assigned, right, by the tribe. If you're a boy, you're going to grow up into a man who does these things. Or if you're a girl, you're going to grow up into a woman who does these things. If you're in a more sophisticated feudal structure, you're born into a class, and you do what your dad does, you do what your mom does, right? So, you know, if you're the firstborn son of the Duke, you don't really have a career option or a career choice. You are groomed to succeed your father. If your father was a bootmaker, chances are good you will learn to become a bootmaker, or you'll be apprenticed out to someone else or something else in the skilled crafts. And if you're a peasant, you're going to, by and large, remain a peasant. So people are defined by these various group and class memberships that they are born into. And the sense that you decide your own career, you decide whom you're going to marry, whom you're going to associate with as friends, what you're going to believe religiously, or the idea that you should have a voice in politics, right, or that you should be able to just go and travel the world however you want by your own individual lights. That's largely non-existent, right, prior to the modern world. But we do see in the Renaissance the development of the cultivation of the individual, right? That I can form my own opinions, I can cultivate my own style, pushing against various class-based memberships. The city-states, particularly in Italy, where we started to see the rise of republican politics, right? The assertion of the individual against various class memberships, even against, right, the Pope and various monarchs, right, and so forth, and the assertion of the individual as I can do my own thing artistically, I can do my own thing intellectually, I can do my own thing politically, and that manifests itself more strongly as the centuries go on. So by the time we get to the 1700s, which is the century of the Enlightenment, all of these strands have kind of matured, right? So you have kind of a self-conscious, mature sciences, self-conscious, mature naturalism. The various organized religions, right, are on the defensive institutionally and politically. They're also on the defensive intellectually as science develops and, you know, the traditional arguments for the existence of God are being challenged. The idea that we can just accept things on faith, right, is being challenged. Everything should be put to the test, right, of reason. Maybe we can prove our way to the existence of God, but it's interesting that if we're going to prove our way to the existence of God, the only arguments that are going to be legitimate are the ones that say we start by observing the natural world and trying to prove logically step by step that therefore there must be a God, and our belief in God is going to stand or fall based on our individual assessment of how good those arguments are. So by the time we get to the Enlightenment, right, sciences are mature, right? We have recognizable physics, recognizable chemistry, recognizable biology and astronomy. Scientific methods, tools, statistics, mathematics, our understanding of the experimental method is starting to become, right, more mature. The individualism is starting to be more mature. So the language of the pursuit of happiness that's going to appear in documents like the Declaration of Independence, right, in the 1700s, you know, the right to life, my life, I can do whatever I want with it, my liberty, I can do whatever I want with it, I should be free in my religion, free to publish whatever I want, free to travel, right, wherever I want, that I am not here to serve my masters, that I'm not here to just be a function in a class, that my happiness and my achieving my dreams in life is important. All of those value implications come to be important in the 1700s. Economically, we see the development of private property and the extension of private property beyond the aristocracy. Anybody, right, can own their own property. Anybody can sign contracts in their own name. Slavery starts to be challenged morally in the 1700s. And movements, first mass movements for the first time ever, to say every human being, no matter what their slave status, should be a free individual and have the pursuit of happiness. Women, right, are also human beings. They have reason. They can think for themselves. They should also have the same rights. All of this is coming to fruition in the 1700s. So the modern world then is shocked by, historically, all this is happening in just a few centuries, you know, revolutions in science, revolutions in religion, revolutions in social movements, the status of women, the status of slaves, religious toleration, political revolutions in a democratic and political direction in France, in England, and so forth. So all of that is the Enlightenment, and it's very modern, right, obviously, because if you contrast that with the intellectual and social world 300 or 400 years earlier, the dominant beliefs and the dominant institutions have changed almost 180 degrees. Okay, so that's the first question, and I think I went over 5 minutes. All right, so I think what I would do next is go to question number 2 and talk about the 4 primary leaders of the postmodern movement.
Okay. Yeah, and if we get time, maybe, I don't know, I know sometimes when I do interviews, I'll have them, like, once you do that, I'll tell you to condense it even more.
Oh, do it again and say it all.
Do it again and try to make it, like,
okay,
2 times shorter. If we can't get to it, that's fine.
Okay, all right, that's fine. Of course, you might just go through and cut and paste, right, as you...
Yeah, it's just hard to... Sometimes you want a really...
You want the continuity,
version,
yes.
Just a little
okay.
Bit,
so all right, do you want me to give you a 2-minute version of that?
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay, all right.
If you want to. Or if you think you want to come back later.
Let's do the 2-minute version now while it's fresh, and then we'll...
Okay.
Getting too strong?
Maybe?
Okay.
Maybe. It's just going a little... But it's good.
Okay.
All right.
All right. The Enlightenment and why it's modern. Well, the Enlightenment is typically the 1700s. Historians will debate a decade or two on either side of the 1700s. But it's a self-conscious intellectual and then a social and political activist movement, right, saying that now we've finally figured out what we need to lift human beings out of centuries and millennia of ignorance and submission and poverty. The arguments are going to be that what we need to do is appeal to experience, right, and reason. That every individual has the capacity to experience the world for himself, right, or increasingly, right, herself, to think about it. Again, education is going to be important here, and to come up with reasonable conclusions on all issues. Anybody can become a scientist. Anybody can govern their own life and take charge of their own economic affairs. Anybody can think about political issues and so contribute to the political process. So what we find in the 1700s is the idea that science is a legitimate enterprise. And by the time we get to the 1700s, there's recognizable physics, there's recognizable chemistry, there's recognizable biology and astronomy. Those didn't really exist 3-4 centuries ago. By the time we get to the 1700s, we have the birth of early free market capitalism, right? A breakdown of feudalism and people being tied to the land in serfdom relationships, right? And so anybody, right, can choose their own career. You don't have to get special permissions, say, from the king, right, to go into a line of business. Anybody can sign contracts, right, in their own right. Adam Smith, 1776, height of the Enlightenment and the birth of modern, right, free market capitalism. We find in the 1700s a series of democratic and republican political revolutions, a gentler one in England, right, more fireworks, obviously, in the United States, and then even more fireworks in the French Revolution. Also, those all in the 1700s as well. For the first time in human history, movements dedicated to the elimination of slavery, right, and the idea that slavery should be morally and politically offensive, right, in the name of slaves and are human beings, and so they should have the freedom to govern their own lives politically, economically, right, and so forth. Religious revolutions, the rise of religious toleration. You know, the first article of the Bill of Rights in the American context is separation of church and state, right? So that each individual should be left to experience religion for themselves and to make their own judgment, and this should not have any forceful authoritarian institutions telling people what they can and can't think. So it's a self-conscious intellectual and political movement that has revolutionized how we think and setting up new institutions in science, in religion, in politics, in economics, and all other dimensions of social life.
Good.
Okay. I think that was actually more like a 3-minute version, but there we go. All right, 4 primary leaders of the postmodern movement. The 4 I focus on the most, there are dozens, right, of people who are significant here, but in my judgment, the 4 most important for slightly different reasons are going to be Richard Rorty, Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, and Jean-Francois Lyotard. And I'll say a few words, right, about why I think each of those is important. Richard Rorty, primarily of importance in the American context or the English-speaking world context, because he came out of the analytic tradition. Analytic philosophy was the dominant, right, approach to philosophy in the English-speaking world in the 20th century. And you might make an argument that it still is, but he is someone who is well-versed in all of the ins and outs of analytic philosophy and its antecedents and all of the arguments epistemologically that are going to end up in very skeptical and relativistic places. He is first rate in knowing that history and showing on all of the important epistemological developments. We end up in fairly skeptical, right, conclusions. He also forthrightly is arguing that the Enlightenment has failed and that the age of faith that preceded the Enlightenment has also failed. So the idea that we can turn to religion and that religion is going to give us the true sets of answers about the universe, how the universe works, the world, the way reality is, and what our values should be and what the meaning of life is, that's an utter failure from his perspective. The modern, right, substitution, right, saying that through science, right, and political freedom and the appropriate kind of education, we can figure out the way the world really works and what human beings really need to put together human flourishing human lives, that whole movement has also been a failure. So the Age of Faith and the Age of Enlightenment, or the pre-modern approach and the modern approach, are both failures self-consciously in his perspective, and so therefore we need to go beyond that. We need to be post, right, modern. So he's important, right, for those reasons. Michel Foucault, I would mention him probably. Obviously, he was hugely important in the continental right approach, but he has been perhaps the more sexy postmodern thinker from the North American and English-speaking right world approach after the 60s and the 1970s. Here, he also has a PhD in philosophy, also had a PhD in psychology, but his focus is on the power dynamics and the tendency, the very strong tendency that we find in postmodernism to say that we're not really about truth, we're not really about justice, we're not really about reality, that everything comes down to power relations, and we understand everything in terms of asymmetries of power. Some people have more power, some people have less power along various social dimensions, right? Race, class, gender, whatever social dimension, right, one is interested in, and we try to understand all of social dynamics in terms of these power asymmetries, and from his perspective, a sympathy with those who have been kind of historically and still are on the losing end, right, of those power struggles. But he's also important not only for the kind of the power of his analysis that he's convinced a lot of people. In much of the cases, he writes unusually clearly, right, for a postmodern thinker. That's also true of Richard Rorty, which I think is partly why they rise to the top of the heap here. But he's also historically informed, and he goes back to Heidegger, who's also extremely important in the generation before him, and then to Friedrich Nietzsche in the generation right before him. And of course, when you get back to Nietzsche, right, Nietzsche has the concept of the will to power, and so Nietzsche is one of the critiques of modern right ways of thinking, and arguing that if we look at things correctly, we will see that really power is fundamental, and we have to recast all of our understandings in terms of power. So by the time we get to Foucault, we get a very sophisticated development from Nietzsche on through Heidegger, and then into the last half of the 20th century in Foucault, and so that's why he's important. Jacques Derrida, I think, also is very important. Again, a name everyone needs to reckon with. I think earlier in his career, he was more philosophical. Again, a PhD in philosophy. He's most famous for the deconstruction method, which is most widely used in literary circles. It's a method of analyzing texts, but it ends up being a very relativistic and skeptical approach to text. So you can always take any text and play around with it, and show that there are hidden meanings or layers of meanings or apparent or binaries, so that a formulation can be interpreted in multiple ways. And so in crude form, you can make a text say almost anything that you want. And part of that is going to be the argument that language itself is indeterminate, that it's not really able objectively to capture the way the world is, that it's ultimately subjective and pliable, so language is something that we just play around with and is not helping us to really understand truth in any objective sense. And in his early career, he did write some very sophisticated, I think, articles that show he is operating kind of at the first level, right, in terms of philosophies of language and the histories of various movements and why he thinks we need to reach the skeptical conclusions that he does. But I think Derrida's significance has been more, I actually, this is perhaps not fair, but I think of him more of a performance artist, right, of postmodernism, because he was a very colorful, dynamic performer, right? And so there was a kind of a fun playfulness just in watch him take, you know, any position and play around with it. And as many postmoderns are, very sophisticated, right, with the language, and could could put on a good show, right? And that's very appealing. And so it's very attractive because, of course, you know, people like a good show, right? And so forth. Jean-François Lyotard, I like him. I would have to say I've learned from all of them, even though I disagree with all of them, right, fundamentally. Lyotard, I sometimes think of him as the most sophisticated, right, of all of them, because he had a very first-rate philosophical education. The thing I would cite him for, though, is that postmodernism, once you leave the academy, its the most significant impact has been in the broader arts and culture, right, segment of society. So postmodernism in the arts is a real thing and a significant, right, cultural force. And in my view, Lyotard is the most sophisticated in understanding the postmodern aesthetics, diagnosing postmodern aesthetics, and then tracing the various intellectual and aesthetic movements going back to Kant. And he has some very sophisticated things about Kant, both his epistemology and his critique of judgment, to explain why Kant really is the important thinker if you want to understand both modern art and postmodern art. So given the significance of the postmodern movement in the artistic world, I think Lyotard is a force to be reckoned with there. So I'd say all four of them are significant because they see themselves as reacting against what they call the pretenses of the Enlightenment. They also see themselves as saying that the Enlightenment had certain ideals, but all of those ideals have been shown intellectually and culturally to be failures. And so they see themselves in a very sophisticated and informed way saying we need to go past that. And they're very, in some cases, ruthless in saying that we have to jettison entirely the Enlightenment package and face whatever ugliness deconstruction is going to give us. Okay. Now there's a question here then about, right, the deconstruction of language and how it relates to postmodern epistemology. Nope, it's going to be, I would say, close to another hour, so you're going to need to be patient. Yeah, I did. Okay. So when it's another 40 minutes, then you can start getting impatient, okay? Let's agree at 7 o'clock you can officially start getting cranky.
I already am. I've been here for like 3 hours.
Okay, well, why don't you go walk around? You have some options.
Okay. But I'm tired.
Well, if you want to rest, you can go into the lounge down there. There's a sofa you can stretch out on. If you want to watch stuff on YouTube or whatever, we can set that up for you too. Okay. All right. Role of language, deconstruction of language. We've already spoken, right, a little bit, right, about that, so maybe we can skip that one. I'm actually going to jump to number 10 and say something about Kant and why I see him as the turning point.
Don't start yet.
Okay.
You want me to switch glasses? They bother
me? Oh, not at all.
Looking at yourself?
No, it's fine. I can actually see your eyes a little bit right through there. Okay.
I can put them on. I'm just missing that.
Yeah, no. Don't worry about that at all. Yeah. I'm actually going to, I think, sandwich numbers 9 and 10. Okay, I'll say a little bit about the counter-enlightenment. Okay. All right. You see, postmodernism as an heir to the counter-enlightenment. Postmodernism is a 20th century movement, I would say a late 20th century movement. But if you do intellectual history, there is an earlier era called the counter-enlightenment. And on my analysis, the counter-enlightenment, which was essentially starts toward the tail end of the Enlightenment, say around 1800 or so, that there was a very sophisticated set of reactions against Enlightenment philosophy and the way it was trying to transform society, that over the course of several generations in a philosophy and philosophically informed history and law and politics that led to kind of a counter-revolution that came to fruits in the 20th century. So the counter-Enlightenment thinkers were very worried by what they saw as Enlightenment reshaping of philosophy and society. So for example, if you are a traditionally religious thinker and the Enlightenment is championing science and reason, well, one of the things that seems to happen when you scientifically investigate the universe, you start to come up with very good scientific explanations for things that traditionally only religion had an explanation for. And if the scientific answers seem to be better, right, than the traditional religious answers, then religion goes into retreat, right? And so there had been, in the modern world, a retreat in the number of people who are strongly believing in religion, right? And that trend line is worrisome to traditional religious thinkers. So if you follow that trend line and you say as science increases, religion is decreasing, then project that into the future, what is going to be left for religion to do? The chances are good that science will totally replace religion. And so if we think there is some value in religion, we need to fight back. So there was a beginnings of a fighting back, right, against what they would say is the overweening, right, claims that science can answer all of life's questions or everything is amenable to rational analysis, to try to preserve some part of the universe, perhaps some part of a supernatural dimension that is off limits to science, right? Or to say that some things could legitimately be believed on faith, that we don't have to put everything to reason and experience. Or if we start to say that people should be individuals, and individualism, right, is very strong, and the pursuit of happiness, right, is every human being's birthright, well, again, traditionally minded social thinkers start to say, well, we want to have a society, and societies need to have everybody agreeing on certain things, and if we have too much individualism, that's going to undermine certain social bonds, right? And people are already challenging authority all over the place, right, as a result of the Enlightenment. Maybe they're going to challenge all of this, the things that hold society together, and we're not going to have genuine society anymore. We're just going to have a bunch of individualistic atoms, people running around, challenging anything, everything, right, and so forth. So maybe we need to put limitations on individualism and assert or reassert perhaps the authority of society and certain social commitments and social obligations over, right, individual freedom and individual pursuit of happiness. All right, or if we take this notion that I should do, right, what I think is happy, well, what happens to this idea, you know, that people have duties, right, that they have obligations, that maybe what we need to do in our ethical theories is to say, well, maybe happiness should be further down the list, but first and foremost, people have obligations and duties, and maybe once you've fulfilled your due duties and your obligations, then you can start to think about happiness. So all of these fundamentals about the proper order of reason and individualism and the pursuit of happiness are being challenged by various counter-Enlightenment thinkers. And I was going to carry on, right, say. Now, in my view, Immanuel Kant is the most important of the counter-Enlightenment thinkers, and I recognize that this is very controversial because on many historical and philosophical accounts, Kant is seen as the height of the Enlightenment. And then when you mention who are the giant names in Enlightenment thinking, right, in many people's lists, you will find Immanuel Kant right up there with John Locke and Voltaire and the others. And I do think that's a mistake. Right? And I would make that as a mistake because while Kant is an advocate of reason, right, in some very modern, right, sounding senses, he is arguing fundamentally that reason is not capable of coming to know reality. Right? His argument is that reason is a subjectively constructing, right, phenomenon, right, that some raw material, right, comes in from reality, it goes through various sense perceptual filters of space and time, and then various subconscious categorizing, right, things and so forth, that by the time things are presented to our conscious minds, right, they have been filtered and constructed by various, right, subjective mechanisms. So we cannot, on principle, know that what we are aware of maps onto the way reality, right, really is. And he mounts some very sophisticated, least skeptical arguments, drawing on, again, a now almost two centuries tradition to say it is impossible for reason to come to know reality as it is. Right. So his famous Copernican turn, right, in philosophy, or Copernican revolution, Copernicus is the one who argued that we need to understand the structure of the heavens in terms of the sun at the center and the planets rotating around it, rather than seeing the earth as the center and everything rotating right around it. That's the Copernican shift. That what we need to understand on Kantian terms is that it is the subject, right, that sets the terms for what counts as knowledge. It is not the objects, right, that set the term for what counts as knowledge. So he is forthrightly but very sophisticatedly rejecting objectivity and replacing it with a deep, right, subjectivity. So that, I think, is a fundamentally important epistemological turn. And on my analysis, what you see over the course of the next two centuries, right, Kant articulates this in the 1780s, right, postmodernism is maturing two centuries later, is a working out of the Kantian turn, right, in philosophy epistemologically. Now, I'd say Kant is also, I think, important because, you know, in addition to saying he wants to deny kind of knowledge of reality in order to make room for faith, he does want to save some room for traditional religion in some form, right, or other. He's also self-consciously rejecting the individuality and the pursuit of happiness ethic, right, that had come to ascendancy in the age of the Enlightenment as well. And so he is reasserting again in very sophisticated form a duty ethic, right, that first and foremost, right, our noumenal reason that in some sense is tapping into or receiving signals from some other realm, it really is issuing commands that hold and bind upon us universally, and that a moral person does not act in his or her self-interest or in anybody else's interest. Interests and inclinations are totally set aside, that we fundamentally should be obeying commands dutifully. So he is reasserting a duty ethic, and in that sense he's also challenging fundamentally the ethics of the Enlightenment. Now Kant, I think, is mixed on his ethics. He does have some individualistic elements, but he is very important for the next generation. Johann Fichte, Georg Hegel, and others who saw themselves as working in the Kantian framework and extending it in some cases, taking it in different directions. But by them, by the time you get to those individuals, you get philosophies that are very anti-individualistic, particularly in Hegel's form. And then we know, of course, Marx is in the next generation after Hegel, and his great influence is also very anti-individualistic. Now, I think you can see the turn suggested, right, in Kant, turning away from individualism in the pursuit of happiness, and the increasing collectivism of the encounter Enlightenment starts to manifest and grow more strongly, and that does culminate in postmodernism, because postmodernism is a very anti-individualistic, group identity-centered movement. Okay.
Me and check on your
daughter? No, she'll be fine. Yeah. All right, let's see.